Hi, this is Pep Phelan from the Melbourne Poach Centre. I have with me today Sue-Ann Hunter. Hello, Sue-Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
That's okay. I'm really excited to talk to you today. As a start, tell us about yourself, where you're from, and what your profession is.
So I am a Wurundjeri woman. And just in saying that, I just generally do. So I'd like to acknowledge that I am on the land of the Wurundjeri people. I'm not sure where you are, but I just want to honour my ancestors and elders, past and present. And I always do that because my knowledge that I get isn't just academic. It's from those people that have passed it down to me. And I need to honour them because I don't feel my knowledge is new. It's old knowledge that I bring with a twist, if that makes sense. So I always like to mention them first of all. It's really hard to say what my profession is because I do a lot of things and I've studied a lot of stuff. So people call me a therapist, a healer, a social worker, a teacher, whatever. But I guess for me, I like to share knowledge and tell stories in a context that people understand. So you're probably a cultural storyteller of some sort of description. Yeah.
I am on your country, so thank you for having me here.
You're welcome.
And I pay my respects to yourself and your elders and your people. So I appreciate being able to live here on your beautiful country. How did you get interested in your particular professional field?
I think I fell into childhood trauma and working with our mob, and particularly our kids. I just fell into it. I got in my early 20s, you know, I probably left school at year 10 by then and just had a few different jobs. And I really wanted to connect more with community. And so I really wanted a job that was meaningful. So I was in making people money for people, you know, in different fields. And I wanted to do something for our mob that was meaningful. So there was a job going at VACCA, just a caseworker role. And I was like, oh, I wonder if I, you know, could get it. And I got it. And then I love learning. I really love learning. And I think working with our mob under such pressure and with trauma really changed my perspective. And I guess the more I worked, the more I wanted to learn. And so that's really where there was a big shift, probably really early 20s, about, hang on, what's going on here? It also brought to light my own trauma that I didn't realise what it was or what to call it. And so out of that grew my curiosity about understanding our mob, but also really realising that we need to change the next generation as I was going along. So my motto is, if we can change and heal this generation, then we've saved some stuff for the next generation to be healed in. So I guess that's where I come from. I'm really curious and I love learning and unpacking, you know, the crux of it, of what's going on and what it is.
I know that you said you started as a caseworker with VACCA.
Yeah.
What was your pathway from there? So what was your educational pathway to eventually end up a social worker? And have you specialised in anything particular, and how did you go about doing that?
No, look, my pathway study is so all over the place and it's so unconventional, it's ridiculous. First off, I just did any workshops that were available, you know, through work. And then I went back to uni and didn't quite finish my psych degree. And I think it was really challenging for me, I guess, because I didn't have anyone supporting me, helping me study. So I'm first generation, I guess, educated in our family. So when you don't have people supporting you, it becomes a bit tricky. So I never finished and I was like, oh, I'll go back and finish that. And, you know, never did. And then just sort of did bits and pieces that were able to build on that along the way. I did my grad cert in family therapy, which I was able to get recognised for the work that I was doing. So I was a caseworker, then I become a manager of, I'm very ambitious, by the way, so I just like keep going, the team leader for the family support programs for the state, if I remember, and then just grew from there. So I was in VACCA for like 19 years, so I left last year and I ended up going from a caseworker to a principal prac that oversaw all the practice for the state. So I'm nearly finished my master's in social work, so I've probably got about two or three subjects in a placement, but I put it off this year due to COVID. It was just the pressure of working, schooling, and I was getting behind, so I just deferred for a year. I've also done I went to Harvard Medical School and did the Global Mental Health Trauma Recovery Program there, which was in Italy. So there's little old me, who didn't even finish high school, traveling to, you know, Italy to go to Harvard Medical School. It was just the most amazing experience. And I think I was on the train from Rome to Orvieto, and I was just like, what am I doing? What am I doing? I don't know enough. And I just remember that whole experience. It was a really good turning point because I realized people are people. And it doesn't matter what you know, and everybody comes with the same shit. And so even though you study it and you practice it and you know it, doesn't mean you got your shit together. So I think that was a really good eye-opener for me. I would say it instilled a lot of learning that I already learned about trauma, but it also helped me meet a whole range of people for networking around the world, which has been absolutely amazing. And I guess on my journey, I've been lucky. I'm not sure if you've heard of Bruce Perry. He's a neuropsych. Yeah. So, you know, he's been one of my great supporters and mentors. And Annie Judy Atkinson is just amazing. Her daughter, Dr. Carly. I think I've been blessed in that I've been able to meet these people and form relationships and friendships with them and really just draw on their knowledge to assist me. So it's just been this weird journey of learning a whole heap of stuff. You know, I think 2 years ago I was in Boston at an EMDR conference doing a fellowship. And I'm like, what am I doing here? How did I get here? I'm just amazed at when an opportunity arises, I just grab it because I don't know where it's going to take me. And even though I'm scared and have no idea where I'm going to end up, I think the lessons are more than just educational about people and trauma and other people's experiences. So, yeah.
So EMDR is eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing therapy.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, which I'm aware of, obviously, because my master's, I sort of focus very specifically on psychological injury, particularly PTSD and psych trauma.
Yeah.
So I'm aware of it. Do you utilize it as part of your practice now with the communities that you work with? And if you do, how does it actually work?
I have a really good friend, she's not Indigenous, and we were doing some case study together, which took us over 2 years, and she's done EMDR for years and years. And she kept saying, oh, you got to try this. And I'm like, oh my God. In the end, I said, all right, let's just try it. You know, and I don't mind sharing my story. I had a stillbirth with my first daughter, and that sort of stuck with me. And it just didn't matter what I did, the pain and the suffering of all that was still with me. And so I tried EMDR and, oh my goodness, did it work? I reflect a lot and I think that's just, you know, part of the studies. And I remember I rang the person that I did it with a week later and I said, there's something missing. I feel like this, I don't know what it is. And he's like, what do you want about? You know, what is it? And I said, I don't know. And then I rang him a week later and I said, you know what it is? I had this underlying sense of anger that was gone. You know, and I didn't even realize I had it. And that's when I realized that, hey, man, this shit works. You know, I'm so good, I'm going to become a therapist in it. So I went and did some training with a good friend of mine. And then I also did a fellowship where we went to Canada, Cambodia, and America and looked at, does trauma play a part in EMDR therapy and what does that look like? I can tell. And I don't, but I could tell somebody the story of that day of that birth and it doesn't overwhelm me. It's sad and I still have feelings around it, but I'm not overwhelmed by grief and loss. So I'm just so grateful that I was introduced to it. So how it works is it's like if you think about in the context of when you go to sleep, rapid eye movement, it's a replication of rapid eye movement while you're awake. And so you sort of use your fingers back and forwards or a light so your eyes follow and become that rapid eye movement. So you bring the memory into your brain and you think about that memory. But you also think about what you want to think about yourself in a positive light, so cognition, and then you start processing. And the mind is and the body are amazing. I'm lucky because I have people around me that trust me. So if they come to me for any type of therapy, say, this is a bit weird, but just work with me. And then they just go, holy shit, that's great. That works. So if you can let yourself go with it. First, I thought it was a bit of, what's this voodoo magic stuff? But you know, it works. It doesn't work for everybody, but it worked for me and I'm a really big advocate of it. Yeah.
So is that one of your main modalities that you use as part of your therapeutic process, or are there other ones that you tend to go to first or use in conjunction?
So I guess generally, because I really only work with MOB, is that, and I'm sure everyone's experienced this, when someone starts to tell you their story and they become dysregulated, or they're just like, because they just need to get it all out, or they start crying, that's not for me, as a, if I go into a therapist mode, that's not helpful. And so generally I will use, and people are going to hate me for saying this, I'll use the EMDR as a way of taking what I call the sting out of the story. So then you can tell the story in your own words, regulated, thoughtful way. That's when people, I feel, this is sort of the, my way, is when people are able to do it in a thoughtful way without, they can start to make connections themselves. You know, when you're talking about, I guess when you're talking about something, and you go, oh, it's okay, I don't need to talk about it anymore, I get it, because your brain and you hear yourself say it. That's some of the work that people can do themselves. So I just feel like I'm facilitating that process. The other one is I love doing body work and people really getting in touch with their feelings. So my favourite part is with kids, when you get them to have tea parties with feelings. So you get them to sit with anger, or you get them to sit with sadness, you know, and even if it's like, 2 seconds, you're like, oh, high five, you sat with that, you know, and the next week you go a bit more, because they get scared of their feelings. And I think at a young age, if we can start to feel and be in our bodies, it's really important. So I think with older MOB, it's a little bit harder, but I'll generally use, you know, a base of EMDR about where do you feel it in your body? What does it feel like? Describe it for me, because we hold it everywhere. And I think we forget that we do hold the whole lot in our body. And I'm really mindful when I'm working with people, say, stop, breathe, just breathe. And they're like, why? Your jaw's clenched. Like, I'll notice the body mannerisms. And if I can point it out and I'll say, I was doing something and I realized my jaw was clenched. And so I stopped and I took a breath and I thought about where I was. And, you know, it's really helpful. That makes my day, because they're not, you know, I don't want to be in someone's life for 5 years doing therapy. If I can just give little bits to help move along, then I think that's, you know, helpful and useful.
Who has been the greatest influence on your professional life, and who is it that you look up to professionally to be the best that you can be, or to do the work that you want to do?
There's so many people that I take bits from, and that people are so generous with their knowledge and their wisdom. The biggest influence on my life and her story that I never got to meet would be the one woman we all descend from, Annie Barat. And so that's William Barat's sister. And so if it wasn't for her, we wouldn't be here. And, you know, I don't share her story because some of it's not great as an Aboriginal woman back on, you know, in the days of colonisation. But I think of what she went through and I think, you know, wow, the challenges I have are nothing compared to that. And I think, as I get older, I really draw inspiration off all my aunties, all my elders, and think, you know, you've paved the way for me to be where I am. You know, one of the biggest, you know, in the trauma field would be Bruce Perry, just his work and his humbleness and his willingness to share. Aunty Judy, who's always willing to share. And I tell you, she rang one day and said, I just wanted your view on this. And I was like, what? Me, little old me, you want my view? And I was just like nearly just beside myself. There's so many people that I admire and that influence me in different ways. I don't know if I particularly have one, if that makes sense. I remember we did training together and all those women in that room with us, that training we did, including yourself, there was different aspects. And I was like, wow, look, that's amazing. And that's, you know that saying, everybody's my teacher?
Yeah.
That I really take that on board. And I try not to put everyone on a pedestal, because I just think when people say to me, oh, you know, you're amazing and you do this, I've got my flaws as well, and so do other people. And, you know, but in spite to get to where they are, I think, you know, there's just, even the kids inspire me that I've worked with, their stories, their lessons, and, you know, everybody's a teacher. So I don't know if there's one particular person other than Annie that I draw the strength off, but yeah, I don't think I have one in particular.
What are the core values and your beliefs about the world that underpin the work that you do?
I would say for me, honesty and integrity are the two of the biggest values, particularly for me, that I hold quite dear. As a, I think I explain it to the kids this way. I hear lots of stories and people tell me, you know, some terrible things that have happened to them or some things they don't want to tell anybody else, and I have to keep them so no one else in the world can ever hear them but me. And if I tell them that, or, you know, I tell an adult in that way, then, you know, what an honour and a privilege. So I have to uphold my honesty and integrity, be able to not disclose those things that they hold dear or that they feel shamed about. The world's pretty shitty, as we know, and we're going through some stuff at the moment that I'm hoping changes the world for the better. But I'm also an optimist and I like to see the best in people. So the fairness, the equality, just people being good people. I got into trauma because it helped me understand why people do what they do. You know, some of the kids I've worked with, their parents have done some terrible stuff, but I'll always say to people, you know, you're not born to do terrible things, but what happened to you to become that or to do that? And that doesn't take away what they've done is okay. It just helps explain, you know, some pretty shitty stuff, if that makes sense.
You know, most people understand how difficult trauma is and the impacts that it can have on a person. But what a lot of people don't understand is that the sibling of trauma is shame. And often people who perpetrate violence that create trauma are full of shame. The people that experience trauma are full of shame. I think that there's just not enough discussion in the world or understanding of how shame impacts us, either as people who go through trauma or live our lives every day, or people who harm others if that's what a person does.
Yeah, perfect way of putting it. Said it perfectly. But I think some of the people need our understanding more than our... It's not to take away from what they did was okay, because it's not, but it's just to understand how people get there. Once you understand that, then you can start to heal it in some way, shape or form.
Yeah, absolutely. What does being a leader mean to you? And does it change if I ask you, what does an Indigenous leader mean to you?
I'm a reluctant leader. I don't like to say I'm a leader, but I keep getting put there for some reason in that spot, whether I like it or not. I think a leader is someone that helps people come along with you and then creates new leaders. I'm big on believing that we can't do things alone. Being an Aboriginal woman and being a leader, that's a whole nother lens altogether. You have to demand your voice be heard if you want to be in that position, and you have to make these waves and make these spaces and places for the next generation to come through, whether you like it or not. And it's bloody hard and it's bloody lonely, because you're standing alone sometimes as a leader, because those ones you want to bring through, you want to stand staunch in what you're doing so that when they get there, they don't have to. It's already paved and it's, they can talk and they can be heard. And as a woman, but as an Aboriginal woman, to be heard and taken seriously is hard. You just feel like you're invisible. And so you have to throw like little, it feels like you're just jumping up and down the room going, I'm here, but no one sees you. But you just have to persist and do that. It's part of the role, I guess.
You've got an incredible group of very strong, fierce Aboriginal female leaders around you, doing your work with Jurujuri, the dancers, and a whole range of others. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. Yes, that's my family. Staunch women that support each other, and, you know, we make ourselves be seen and heard. which is bloody tiring sometimes. So although we're sick of being in lockdown, we sort of sometimes see it as a bit of a break, but you still see us all around, even individually. And we all have our own spaces that we cover and support each other in those spaces.
How do you believe that Indigenous leadership is different to Western models? And what does Western institutions and Western leadership have to learn from Indigenous ways of doing things?
You know, I guess from what I've learned from my upbringing is that more listening than talking, although I just said we have to jump up and down and be heard, we still do that. But at the same time, listening to those around us. And I don't think one person should ever make a decision. I think as a collective, we make better decisions. The Western model of leadership is you have someone in leadership and they make all these decisions. I think, you know, we as a collective come together and all bring different knowledge and wisdom and come to agreement in what, you know, our outcomes and answers should be. I think that's probably the best way to do it, because not one person knows everything. And sharing the load, I think we're pretty good at it. Just not enough of us to share the load with. You know, we're pretty good at that. And we respect people's fields that they're in, and we'll reach out to whoever that person is to get knowledge, not think we just know it. And most of the time we'll commend that person's knowledge as and it's not our own. We'll say, you know, because this person helped us or this person is part of it. Rather than having to put one person up, we all should be there. Leadership is tricky. I don't like being a leader. I fight it every day and I find myself back there every day. I'm trying to go with it, but I have to bring people along with me and I have to surround myself with people with the knowledge in that area, and I always give them credit for what is theirs.
If you had a major influence over your profession or your industry, casework, social work, therapy, how would you change it?
Well, I would take out our 12-week programs for starters and time limits, people having to work with people. There would be no time frames. It would be you take as long as you need to build a relationship, and then you take as long as that family or whatever you want to call it, you know, client needs to heal, and you work with them in the way they need to work. So, you know, it's inclusive. There's self-determination involved. It's, you know, the underpinning is trauma, but that all the healing is done with culture, because we know that's protective, and we know that, you know, that's part of our identity and how we connect. So really working to bring back our old ways of healing. Simple, really.
How are you or the people that you know bringing back those old ways of healing into, you know, this very westernized structure of therapy?
So for me, there's a few. So I just wrote a paper and it's under peer review at the moment. So I can't really
sit there. Congratulations.
Thank you. And that's around how culture is protective. It's how we look. Like, it's not, people think it's a thing that you just do, right? So we're going to give you a smoking and that's part of healing. Yet that is one form of healing, you know, a smoking ceremony or dancing, because it's rhythmic, pattern, repetitive. It helps repair neural pathways and things like that. The other thing we forget about, what's the biggest healing tool, is relationships. So connecting people with family, connecting people with community, connecting people to understand their culture, their language, their country, you know, all those ways of being are actually healing. And the trauma is that they've been removed. So it's about reconnecting them. So for instance, you know, Mandy's waking up language. So for us to start learning it, it's quite healing, because that's our form of expression, and we're regaining that back. That looks different. Simple things like, you know, everybody knows the word Wumanjeka and that it means welcome. Well, it actually doesn't mean welcome. It means, when you break it down, to come with purpose. How beautiful is that? You know, you come onto my land and say, Wumanjeka, you come here with purpose. Like, when you break it down, it's so beautiful. And that's our expression. That's healing.
That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. And this is the stuff that has been so lost or asleep, as they say, the correct translation of language.
That's your form of expression as a peoples. And so if you can't understand your expression, then you sort of think, 'cause there's, you know, words that are missing. Oh, we don't have that. I wonder why we didn't have that. And then you start to think about, well, we didn't need it. So, yeah.
What do you love most about your profession or your career?
I don't do as much therapy anymore. So I've got a few things happening. So I'm with Snake and I'm the sector development manager. And I think, you know, after 20 years, I want my learnings and my understandings, I want to pass them on. So now I work nationally empowering workers to work with our kids. In that space, I'm also able to access policy for change. So I have a say in that as well. But I just love passing on the things that I've learned, you know, those little pearls of wisdom, and people go, and you get light bulb moments. You know, I love that. But I still love working with, I always love working with mob because I learn so much. I've done a lot of work recently with non-Aboriginal workers working with mob, and they'll do case studies or they'll present a case and making those connections for them that, you know, that next time they work with mob, they're going to do it better. So, you know, there's a range of things that I love to do that just passing on the wisdom, I guess, that I've been able to, been so lucky enough to be part of.
You've just brought up something really great, because my next question to you was, what does allyship mean to you?
I think the well-intentioned allyship is good. And I think if people come into the space, and, you know, people come into the space and they say, oh, I really want to learn. Well, if you're going to learn and I tell you to shut up, you're going to have to shut up and learn. Just listen is part of what you firstly need to do. And then you can ask questions around that. But I think sometimes people come in to tell you what to do, and that's not allyship. If you want to share this space with us, then I will fiercely protect my people if you come into this space. And I will honestly tell you when to be quiet and when to listen. And I'm happy to unpack, you know, what you've learned and what it looks like and why you can't do things. But I think it's people sitting back, listening, and creating spaces for us as Aboriginal people to do what we do best. I think that's good allyship.
What are the knowledges, skill sets, and behaviours that you believe make a good ally?
You know what? People have to leave at the door. They know everything, because no one does, right? But particularly in our space, people need to go, right, I just need to throw out what I know and I'm happy to learn new, but I'm never going to know everything. And there's no way I could possibly do this work because it's the work of your own people. And then asking, how do I support you in this? What do you need from me? Do I need to just be in the background? Do I need to, what do you need from me to be able to support you and give you self-determination in this? So I think that's good allyship.
Thinking about you working with non-Indigenous people who are going to be working with mob, what are the really key piece of advice that you would give to them about being responsible, activated, and effective?
So what I found is particularly therapists, they are like thinking, oh my God, they talked about culture. What do I do with that? What do I do with that? And I always say to them, the culture's brought with us as Aboriginal people. Your expertise is in this, and that's just concentrate on that. Because you know what? If you're concentrating on doing the right thing for our people, then you're making a space for the culture to blossom and grow, and you're going to learn so much. Don't in that space sit there and ask 101 questions about culture, because they're not there to teach you. That's for you to go back and learn yourself. But if you don't let your fear get in the way and stop you from doing your expertise with somebody. Yeah, so you don't need to do anything with the culture. It's not yours to do anything with, but let it be in the room.
What do you see are the major keys to empowering the lives of Indigenous people, both locally and around the world?
That's really hard because there's so much. But I think, how do we empower people? I think when you're empowered, you're able to do really good things. To everybody, empowerment looks completely different. Probably an example, if you're not taught to make great life decisions, then being empowered is going to get you to make some really shitty decisions. So first we need to get you to understand what, you know, self-determination. We give you the information so you can make good decisions, and then we empower you to be able to go out and do that. So empowerment and self-determination sort of hand in hand is what we need. And our own leadership, because we know what we want or what we need, I should say.
What's your unique vision for Indigenous people, both in Australia and around the world?
I would like to see in my lifetime, and I don't know if I'm going to, but a generation that's healed, a whole generation that's come through that is so empowered and so strong that they're able to change the world. That's what I want. That's why I do what I do for the next generation.
Sue-Ann, thank you so much for coming in today. It has been an awesome conversation and really, really insightful. And I thank you so much for sharing your time.
No, you're welcome. Thank you.